eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The following podcast is hashtag Boone approved. It's time for another edition of the Brett Boone Podcast.
Remember when me and you almost went to blows? Lou sent me down three times too, so I know what you're talking about.
With your host, MLB All-Star, Brett Boone.
Bottom line is, you will become a successful major league hitter by hitting pitchers' mistakes.
As he sits down with his sports and entertainment friends from around the world.
You are not going to be a successful major league hitter if you hit pitchers' pitches.
This isn't just any former jocks podcast.
To change the outcome, you got to change the income. You got to change what goes in. Then that changes what goes out.
Often duplicated, but never replicated. Just like his bat flip.
Okay, now the party starts. The responsibility starts now.
Now in its fourth year, this is the one and only Brett Boone Podcast.
Welcome to the Brett Boone Podcast. I'm Brett Boone, and today on the program, I'm joined by an old teammate who's an all-star Rolaids relief man winner, which they don't have that award anymore, but he was that. He's a member of the Giants Wall of Fame, currently broadcasting for the Cincinnati Reds, has been for a long time. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Brantley, Cowboy, thanks for coming on the Brett Boone Podcast.
Yeah, buddy. Good to see you, man.
All right. I know I tease you all the time about never being on a horse. Clear it up for all of you. Why are you the Cowboy?
I got that nickname from Lenny Harris back in mine and your playing days.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny how you walk into a locker room and you're wearing cowboy boots. And, you know, I'm not a big horse rider. I do ride horses, but not to the extent that I would consider myself a cowboy-esque type person, but wearing those boots, Lenny thought that was pretty cool. And I had to leave. I was going to get my kids, and he goes, "There goes the cowboy riding off in the sunset." And from that point on, just kind of stuck.
Isn't it funny though? Cause I mean, we were teammates for, I think 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I would just come to the yard and be like, "What's up, cowboy? Hey, Booney, what's going on?" I just took it for that. And I'm thinking, why do I call him the cowboy? I don't know, because everybody calls him the cowboy. And then I remember I used to tease you. I said, "You've never been on a freaking horse." And you'd laugh. And I never got down to it. Like, yeah, why is he the cowboy? What's the mood in Reds camp? Let's get right into it. You're down there in Arizona right now. What's that mood? And is it weird not having Joey Votto around? Been a staple for a lot of years.
I think it is in a sense, simply because we've had Votto here for the last 17, 18 years. And I think anytime you have an icon and possibly a Hall of Famer, it makes things a little different. But there are so many young kids running around and the energy is so high. And I think too, I'll say this, I think that Votto found a place in Toronto. And I think ultimately that's where he's going to find his finish to his career. I think once that happened, it kind of let Reds people let it go a little bit, because I think, you know, everybody cares about Joey. He's been here a long time. He was a great player here. I think that if he was still hanging out in the balance, I think you would still hear some talk about that, especially with some of the injuries that we've had here in the last few days.
Yeah. And, you know, we had careers where we both played for several different teams. Yeah. I was in Cincinnati for five. I ended up logging 7 years with the Mariners. I had a few stops on the way. So yeah, Mariners to me is kind of my home, but you know, it's different for guys like Joey Votto, for guys like Barry Larkin, who you still work with, who from start to finish, that's all they've known is one team. And then all of a sudden, you know, if you date back to the Tony Gwynns or the Cal Ripkins, guys that were there for so long, it's got to be a little bit of a shock for them. You know, we're at the end. We all know when the end of our rope is kind of near. He probably knew his time in Cincinnati was done, but that doesn't mean you're done. Hit a first pitch homer in his first AB in Toronto. Yeah. But that's got to be a little different for a guy like him. Like, wait a minute, I've gone to this camp for 18 years in a row, and now I'm going to some enemy territory.
I think for Joey, it's probably a resurgence of energy. I think anytime you get that late in your career, you're looking for something that gives you that same hype, that same adrenaline rush, that same push from a motivational standpoint that came back when you were a rookie. And I think he has that in Toronto, specifically because that's where he grew up. I mean, that was his hometown team. That was his favorite club when he was growing up. And I think, too, if you look at it from a statistical standpoint, I mean, he's only 25 hits behind Larry Walker for the all-time Canadian hit king. And I know in his heart, I mean, it may not be the forefront of his mind, but somewhere that's an important issue for him.
Yeah, we had him on the podcast and he talked about his growing up in Canada. And that's kind of been his team. Looking at this Reds team now, like you said, young, a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. I remember when I was getting older and I was looking at those young players going, wow, I used to be that guy. You're getting to see it up front. A year ago, they won 82 games under David Bell. Let's be honest, if we're going to talk about divisions in the game, National League and American League, American League Central and the National League Central are probably two of the weakest divisions. But with the new schedule system, they don't beat up on each other within the division like we used to. It's balanced. So let's talk about last year a little bit, what you saw. Obviously, I want to touch on L.A. De La Cruz. Physically, from what I see, freaky type athlete. When I say freaky, I mean it in a good way. But last year, let's go good, bad, and the ugly.
I think last year, the pitching staff really had a tough time really getting a foothold to begin the season. I think anytime you're a young staff and you have great arms, a lot is – expected of you. And I think a lot is still expected of that pitching staff. Do they have the arms? Yes, they do. Do they have the experience? Well, they're getting there. And I think that's a big key for this club, because when they were on the run last year, they won 12 ball games in a row right in the middle of the year. And nobody really expected them to even get into the hunt, much less have a chance on the last series of the year. And they got themselves back into the race. And I think a lot of it had to do with the promotions of guys like you mentioned, Ellie De La Cruz and Matt McClain. I think it also had something to do with this pitching staff getting healthy, being able to go out and execute on a day-to-day basis every fifth day for the starters. I think what really happened with this club, unfortunately, is as they got into September, and Brett, you know this, you're a young player and you're used to playing 5 months every year. And that's what you do when you're coming up through the minor leagues. And all of a sudden that 6 month jumps on your back. And not only are you're playing to get into the playoffs. Every single day matters. And I think they just ran out of gas. I think they ran out of gas collectively. I don't think it was one or two guys. I think it was the whole bunch of them. And I think they know that now. And I think they'll use that for fuel moving into 2024.
It's interesting you bring up that schedule, because, you know, I've got a son that's playing in the minor leagues. I know you have a son playing at Jackson Academy. Is that right?
Yes.
And isn't it amazing when we're talking to these kids and we're telling, once the seasons start to get long, you know, you start off in high school, you've got a limited, get to college, they stretch it out on you a little bit, play some summer ball. Then you go into the minor leagues and it's, oh, wait a minute, 140 games. And it's like, I said, 140 games. That's nothing. That's like a vacation. We got 162 plus spring training. And if you're lucky and fortunate enough, you get that postseason. You have a great year. You got 190 games that you log. So for a veteran player, for guys that have been around, it's really not a big deal. It's what we do. We plan for it. But you're right. For a young team up and coming, you're used to that 5-month schedule. With today's and today, the way the way they treat the young players. I mean, there's days off. There's scheduled days off. So you're not even playing as much as we used to play back in the day, where that bell rang and it's like, I go until I'm physically showing signs that I need a rest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tough grind, 162 games in 182 days. But you mentioned Ellie De La Cruz. And when I saw him last year and he came to the big leagues, not really anything that he couldn't do as far as throwing the baseball, hitting the baseball, elite in every category. And by elite, I mean a guy that can throw the ball 100 miles an hour from the shortstop position, and he can hit the ball at 120 miles an hour off the bat. And he runs like you would think he was Usain Bolt. I mean, this guy, there's just not anything that he can't do if you had a tools contest. I think anybody that's that toolsy, especially a 6'5 shortstop, there's still a lot of smaller things that you have to get done to be great at the big league level. And I think he realizes that. I think he's worked on that and continues to work on that. We've already seen a bit of a swing change here in spring training, and it's proved great dividends. And all it really was just kind of shortening the leg kick. Basically not so much of that softball kind of big leg kick and big, huge swing, trying to see how far you can hit it, but basically just get the barrel of the bat to the baseball. And it's shown up well for him, not only with the fact that he's making better contact, but he's actually walking more.
Yeah. And I looked at when he kind of burst on the scene last year, this is a guy, this is a franchise type guy you put on the cover of the media guide. He's got all the flair. He's kind of reminds me a little bit from personality, kind of like a Fernando Tatis when he first came up. I'm right in your face, and kind of like a rock star mentality, not just how he plays, but how he looks.
Yeah.
I watched him last year. Obviously, the skill set is there. He stole 35 bases, hit some home runs, hit 235, punched out a lot. And I know today's game, we're a little more forgiving about the punch out. I understand that. But I looked it up. He punched out 144 times in 388 at bats. That's not a lot of contact. You mentioned the leg kick, and you're seeing that in spring training. I looked at his spring training stats. I think as of today, he's hitting 345, which spring training, yeah, we don't put that much credence into it. But sometimes with a younger player, I think it can be viable as far as seeing his adjustments.
Yeah, I think for all of the guys that we have, and you can list them off. I mean, Matt McClain kind of going through that same spot. Young player came up.
Young second baseman. Yeah.
Young second baseman. Christian Encarnacion Strand, who is going to play first, a little bit of third, mostly first. Those three guys, they've got some serious talent. I mean, they look to me as though they're going to be the guys that will carry this team forward. You've got some other players that are out there. I mean, we lost TJ Friedl 2 days ago. I don't know how long we're going to lose him, but my bet is probably a good 5 to 6 weeks. And he dove for a ball in center field. He broke his wrist, right wrist. And, you know, there's just not a whole lot you can do about that. It's not like you can take a magic pill and that wrist be better the next day. He's out. So the Reds not only have got to put themselves in a position internally to cover that spot, whether it be Fairchild and Benson in a traditional matchup role, or if they're going to rotate some guys out there, or if they're going to go out. And how many times have we seen this, Brett? Late in spring training, somebody goes down, and all of a sudden the trade market begins to pop all over the place.
Yeah, without a doubt. Led the league in stolen bases last year, Cincinnati Reds did. And I just kind of want to go on top of what you're talking about, a young pitching staff. Obviously, the ballpark in Cincinnati, very hitter friendly. Does that have an effect on a young pitcher coming up? Or do you think it gets to a point where pros got to be a pro? And this is what our surrounding is. We pitch just like the big parks where they're pitcher friendly. The position players have to have that attitude. This is what it is for 81 games. Does that play into it at all, or am I overreaching on that?
No, I think the ballpark definitely plays into everyone's mentality. I think that it can be a pro, it can be a con. If you're a guy that doesn't hit many home runs and you think, well, I've got 81 ball games here at Great American Ballpark, maybe I can try to get my home run numbers up. If you do that, you're going to end up the guy that has the 200 plus strikeouts. It just doesn't work that way. What I think is the best mentality is, I know I'm playing in a smaller ballpark. If I'm hitting the ball, if I'm barreling the ball on a line to the gaps, I'm going to get a lot of home runs because that ball is going to creep over the top of the fence. Now, you see young guys that come to the big leagues, and we saw it with Ellie last year. He hit one home run, and it's landing in the river. And after that, he wanted to hit them all that way. And you can't do that. I mean, it's just not possible for that to happen on every swing. But if indeed that is your swing, then you're in trouble. And that what we were talking about a while ago about the adjustments that he's made up here, that tells me, okay, well, he's thinking like a winning baseball player and not just an individual that just wants to play softball and hit the ball out of the ballpark.
Well, it's interesting, and I love it because I love the not necessarily the physical on working with young hitters, but the mental approach. The fact that you said he's cutting his leg kick down, that's so big. I remember a young Josh Donaldson would give me a call and say, Booney, what do you think about this and this? I said, Josh, the leg kick that you have, I love it. I mean, it gives you so much power. I says, but at the big league level, you're going to go through streaks where that leg kick doesn't work and it's off. You've got to know before you go 0 for 15, you've got to know my timing's off and what's my go-to. When everything's right and everything's on point, you can go with that leg kick when it's on time. But you need to know as a big leaguer, when is it not on time and when do I have to survive until I get back on time? It's good. It's good to hear that a player that has the ceiling that he does is already making that adjustment. I mean, I was blown away. And this is years ago when Juan Soto came to the big leagues at such a young age. And I watched him and I watched his approach. I watched right out of the gate, and he's 18 years old. And he's got a two-strike approach at 18. And I'm going, this guy has a plan, and he's going to be very successful with that.
Yeah, I think for the guys that I mentioned with McClain and Encarnacion Strand and Ellie De La Cruz, they are three guys that showed up here last year with the ability to not only survive at the big league level, but with the ability to be great at the big league level. No one really talks about Encarnacion Strand simply because you have Ellie De La Cruz and how well Matt McClain played last year. Encarnacion Strand was a little bit late to the party, but I look back and you can do this in any statistical website that will show you the numbers of this kid going all the way back to his college days in Oklahoma. And you start to follow him as he gets into the minor leagues and level after level after level. When you see a guy across the board, whether he's in high school, college, minor league team, from minor league team, and all of a sudden he hits the big leagues and he's hitting right at 300 with major power numbers, you know what that tells me? The dude can flat rake. It doesn't matter who's standing out there on the mound. He's going to figure out a way to get it done. He is a big, big kid, and he will be a guy that you spin a breaking ball on the 0-1 count in the strike zone, and he's going to hit it to the moon. But he'll also be the guy with the two-strike count in the bottom of the ninth inning facing a closer throwing 105 miles an hour, and he'll feather the ball down the right field line because it's the right thing to do. That's my kind of hitter.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's, you know, I see the strikeout numbers are up. Okay, I get it. The analytics have gotten into it and said sometimes it's better to strike out than to hit into a double play. I have a tough time logistically thinking like that as a hitter. Back in our day, it was striking out is really bad. And it's, you know, I struck out 100 times a year. And, man, I felt, Cowboy, like I struck out 1,000 times. 100 was a lot. I look at the numbers today, I'm like, I couldn't imagine going back to that dugout 200 times and just thinking, it's okay. The game accepts that. I don't know if I'll ever get to that point. You know, I've embraced a lot of the new things and the new metrics, but when it comes to punching out, it's like, no, that's as a hitter. That's our, man, we protect that thing. We protect that thing. When Jeff Brantley's out there at your peak and you're hitting your spots, I'm not going to let you punch me out because the umpire says, a ball was a strike. If it's close, I'm going to touch it. I'm going to touch it. So I don't know. I don't. Maybe I'll get to that point one day. Last year, 13th ERA wise, a little bit to do with the ballpark. 8th ERA as far as the bullpen goes. Got a couple newcomers, Montas and Pagan. Touch on those guys a little bit.
I've watched Frankie Montas throw a good bit this spring. I like his stuff. I like his pitchability. He's one of those cats that can throw any pitch at any time. Really doesn't matter the count. He's got good command. And what I noticed right out of the gate, he's hitting 95, 96 with his fastball. So that tells me that his shoulder's healthy. He's been able to do that throughout spring without really missing a spot. I look at him and then I think back, okay, how difficult is it in Arizona to find your breaking ball? It's tough. It's tough because it's light air. It's tough to get that grip. And a lot of times, especially young pitchers in this light air in Arizona, they start getting over on the side when they get in a regular A game and they're throwing their breaking ball. It's backing up. It's not there. And they get over on the side and they start throwing it and they start hooking it. And all of a sudden you start having elbow problems. Well, Montas doesn't fall into that category because he knows that once you hit that humidity that's in Cincinnati and the rest of the country, except for Colorado, that breaking ball is going to break. So he uses it accordingly. He throws the split as well. I like the guy. And I like him not just because he has good stuff or throws the ball in the mid-90s. I think he's a leader. And I think when you have so many young pitchers, especially in the starting role, it's going to help these guys move forward. And I think Nick Martinez fills that role as well. And I think that Emilio Pagan is going to be a guy that you're going to see pushed back to the back end of the bullpen. I mean, he's going to have the 7-8 innings trying to get the ball to Alexis Diaz.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Rest of the division. I guess the big offseason news was Council going from the Milwaukee Brewers to the Cubs at the last minute. And didn't know that was going to happen. Also, the Brewers, let's talk about the Brewers real quick. They lost their number one. Burns moves on. Take the Brewers a little bit, what you saw last year, what you see coming up this year.
I think the Brewers are regardless of who their manager is, I think they're still going to be a battling type ball club. I think they're going to be lesser because they don't have Corbin Burns. Because Burns was one of those guys that when you ran him out there any given day, I mean, it wasn't like he was just going to win. He might throw a no-hitter. I mean, he was throwing that well. And I think that big combination of Burns and Woodruff was kind of intimidating, regardless of whether you had a veteran ball club or not, because those two guys were rock stars. I mean, they made it really tough for a 48-hour period to not only score a run, just to scratch out a hit. Well, Woodruff is on the shelf with a shoulder issue, will not pitch this year. Burns is now pitching in the American League for the Baltimore Orioles. So That puts Freddy Peralta in the number one spot. You can pitch 3, 4, or 5 in the rotation all you want. And nobody is ever going to question you when you have a rough day. Nobody's going to say anything about, we need you to pitch deeper into the ballgame. When you're the number one guy, you're the boss. You are the guy that's expected to go out there, and it's win day. Every time you come, there are no, I don't really feel that great. Can you push me back? It's win day, and you have to pick it up. And that's a hard role to carry for a guy like Freddy Peralta, who has been prone to some control issues and getting a little too hyped up early in the ball game. When you're the number one guy, you got to be cool as a cucumber, or you're going to have some issues.
Without a doubt. And it trickles down to the position players. Cause when we have that stopper, we're on a 3 or 4 game skid. Oh, but he's pitching tomorrow night. We'll get right again. It's a mentality coming to the ballpark that day. It's all right. We got the big guy going tonight. And when you don't have that guy, there's nobody to stop those skids. And you got to wait for somebody, one of those third, fourth, fifth starters, just have a really good day and stop that skid. That's a great point when it comes to being a number one. And the fact that not only did you have a Burns Woodruff combo that made them so great, I don't want to date ourselves, but it's kind of like a Randy Johnson Schilling. Yeah. There's a reason. When you've got those two horses as a position player, I feel pretty good. If I get a knock and a walk tonight, we got a chance. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have that, you lose that modern day version of that with a Burns and Woodruff. That's a big blow. All right, move on to the Cubs.
I think the Cubs last year had some young pitchers that really burst onto the scene. I think probably the biggest news with the Cubs is they got Bellinger back. And I think that was a huge question mark going through the entire winter. With that being said, you still have to close ball games. You still have to figure out a way to get from the 7th to the 8th to the 9th, sometimes from the 6th to the 9th. And that puts a lot of onus on your bullpen. And I think when you start talking about two teams that could be very good, you have to say Cubs and you have to say Cardinals. But on the same hand, there's a question mark about both of those bullpens. Starting pitching today does not take you to the 8th inning. Heck, it doesn't take you to the 6th most nights.
You're lucky to get to the 5th.
Yeah. So with that being said, you've got all these guys in your bullpen that were I'm just going to kind of pluck them out of the tree. And then all of a sudden, they're the most important guys on your club because they've got to pitch the most important innings when your offense has actually gotten some runs early in the ball game and you're expected to finish it out. When you lose those ball games, that's when your team morale goes right in the tank. And that's what happened with the Cardinals last year. Terrible bullpen. And the same thing can be said about this Cubs bullpen. They had a rough time. If their bullpens are good, they're going to be good.
We'll couple it right into the Cardinals since you mentioned them. Cardinals to me, JB, and they just seem like one of those teams, one of those cities that year in and year out, and some years they've had some really good rosters. But I'll look at their team and I'll break them down before the season and go, there's no reason that this team should go deep into the postseason. Then I look up come postseason time, they're the Cardinals again. They're one of those franchises. I don't know if it's the it's kind of like a Tampa Bay. It's just a culture. You go to Tampa Bay, there's no reason on paper these guys should go to the postseason. Every year they're going to the postseason. Cardinals last year, down year, finishing the basement of that division. Very rare for the St. Louis Cardinals. What do you see for them in 2024?
Well, I think for St. Louis, and I remember this from playing there, they pack that stadium every night. And when they're home, that's 81 ball games where you have an artificial motivator built in. Not the same as when you're on the road, but when you're playing in that ballpark and that's your home team and that's your home ballpark, you come to the ballpark with a different expectation than maybe some of these other clubs that don't draw as well. And I think that in itself really kind of escalates the play of the players for the St. Louis Cardinals, other than the fact that you have two of the best corner men in Goldschmidt and Arenado in the game. So you've got your leadership right there. You've got guys that can push the envelope, and you've got a new kid in Jordan Walker. I'm not so sure how great he is from a defensive standpoint, but But I'll tell you this, he flat out hit. And I don't care who you are on the mound and what you throw, he can hit it. He's that good. So that kind of adds to that mystique of the middle of that order lineup. I think the reason the Cardinals struggled last year is because their bullpen was bad. And I know just from personal experience, when you're a closer and you're not closing, the morale on your team is in the crapper. If you're doing your job, everybody says, all right, we'll get these runs early. They'll close it out and we can come on and we're talking about tomorrow already. But when you're losing ball games in the eighth and the ninth inning, that just totally sucks the life out of your team.
You make a good point, and we talked earlier about today that a lot of finances go into the bullpen, unlike yesteryear. So much relied on the starters when we were playing. And as opponents, as hitters, we wanted to get into that bullpen. Now, a lot of the finances, a lot of the equity is put into the bullpen. And does it seem to you as time goes on in 2024 that when you do have a bad bullpen, it's over because that's the way the game's gone and that's what's important? There's so many teams out there now that have power bullpens. When you don't have one in today's game, it's a lot different. Because even the big guys, JB, you know, back in our day, it was if you were a number one starter, you had the mentality that I'm going nine. That doesn't mean you go nine, but that was the mentality.
Right.
With the exceptions of a Verlander type who's in his 40s now, you don't see that mentality from number one guys out there. It's still, even the number one, you got a Cy Young Award winner sitting out there in free agency without a team who's very known for going five. And that was unheard of back in our day. Do you see that more of a theme? The teams that can't compete bullpen-wise with the best bullpens are going to have a tough time in today's game.
I do. I think that is a trend we're heading in. And to be honest with you, Brett, I don't know that that's going away anytime soon because we're putting ourselves from a developmental standpoint throughout our minor league systems, and every major league club relies on that. We're only allowing some of our top prospect pitchers, and those are the guys that we expect to be in the big league soon. We're only allowing them to pitch sometimes 3 and 4 innings as a starter because we don't want to put too many innings on their arm. It's the opposite of what we had back in the day when Nolan Ryan and Tom Seaver and these guys were coming to the big leagues, where they would log major innings so that when they hit the big leagues, it wasn't a huge surprise. Oh my gosh, I've got to pitch in the 6th inning now. What are you kidding me? It's 9 o'clock. It's not the 9th inning. It's 9 o'clock. I got to get out of the game. I'm tired. I mean, that's how you look at it sometimes. That's the most difficult part of this game that we're going to face moving forward. It's not getting extra arms for the bullpen. We can find that. And good teams with big money, they'll do that. It's finding starters that you know you can count on for 6 or 7 innings. And I say that to myself, and I'm thinking, who are they? They're not anybody out there. 6 or 7?
It's unbelievable. I'll tell you a little story. When Aaron got back into the game and started managing, you know, we talk probably once a week. And he would ask, you know, he asked me for advice sometimes. Sometimes I give it to him. Sometimes he listens. Sometimes he doesn't listen. But I remember early on, because my mentality was back 15 years ago when I was still playing. And I thought, Aaron, you got to be really careful with your starting pitchers in the 5th inning. When they got the lead, you take them out of the game. Those are fighting words. But now, fast forward to 2024, I don't know if they're fighting words anymore. There's not as much precedent put into the wins and losses. So that's not a big deal to those guys. But it's like, I remember, man, there was a time where you've got your starting pitcher in the 5th. He's got to finish that half inning. He's got the lead. You take him out, there's going to be a brawl. Nowadays, it's kind of, oh, here's the ball. You know, it's 2-1 in the 4th, and you're out of juice. So let's move. Well, that just negates his win or loss. That gives it, puts it in the hands of somebody else. That's the mentality we're at.
Yeah, it's gone to a point where even if you have a shutout or you're throwing a one no hitter, I mean, managers are pulling these pitchers out of the game, and there's no repercussions from the guys that have the ball in their hand. You know, and the way I look at it, and I'm sure you look at it the same way, it's your career. You're the one that's going to look silly at the end of time when when your kid turns over your baseball card and he says, "Well, Daddy, you were a starting pitcher. You only pitched 85 innings." You kidding me?
You're right.
What are you going to say? I'm a three inning pitcher, son.
As a hitter, I used to think I got to be in the lineup. I have to be in the lineup. I've got an injury, but I've got to play because I've got to drive in 100 runs. I have to get there. I can't drive in, you know. It's very selfish, but I think our game is an individually selfish game. And if you put your thoughts and what you're trying to do in the right direction, you become a team player by doing your job to the fullest. But I remember thinking, I can't miss five games. What if I drive in 98? You know, from a selfish perspective, I need those numbers. Nowadays, it seems like, let's take a little sore. Let's take a week. Let's take 10 days. And I pull my hair out going, how could you do that? How can you go home and be okay with that? I can't do it. But that's the mentality. That's the culture. That's the way the young players are brought up today. So really, I don't know if I can actually get on them for that. It's the way the game teaches them. That's okay.
Yeah. I think we are in a position to where we have individuals that are crunching the numbers, and it says, okay, for the last four starts, this pitcher, when he's gotten to pitch number 69, he's gotten tired. He doesn't have quite the same speed spin on the ball. The ball's not riding. It doesn't quite have the same snap. Now, I realize he struck out every batter that's come to the plate, but at this point, he's gotten to 69. He's tired. Let's tell him he's tired. What are we doing? How do you ever get to a point where you're great at 85 to 100 pitches when the guy's telling you you're tired at 69?
Right. It becomes mental already. I watch these young hitters, JB, and I watch them train and I watch them prepare for the season. And I'm not saying a veteran seasoned big leaguer. That's different. I'm talking about young players that are on the cusp of getting to the big leagues. And we're working out in the off season, and it's that monitor that's monitoring your exit velo, which I never heard of until now. And if they go in, have a good day, move the ball around the cage, and I'm sitting there listening I can shut my eyes and know if it's good contact. And you come out of there with a really good session, but then you get your printout and your exit velo was 2 miles an hour, what it was off of on Tuesday. All of a sudden, these kids are driving home in their car going, how'd my exit velo go down? How'd my exit? That becomes a mental, I don't know. I don't even know what the word is for it. It becomes a mental thing that do we really need that in the game as a young player? We got enough things to worry about. This game's hard. Hitting a baseball is hard, especially at the big league level. But to add in that, oh, wait a minute, what's wrong with my exit velo? Instead of coming out of there going, that was a great session. I moved the ball around. My swing is just where it's supposed to be. I don't care how hard it is. I know when I hit that ball smoked into a gap somewhere. I don't care if it goes 410 feet or 414 feet. Yeah, that's a good swing.
We all want to do things technically correct. I think that's the drive for every player to get in a position to where you can repeat your swing or repeat your mechanics over and over and over again. But when it comes game time and you step across the lines, all of that mentality has to go out of the window, and then you compete. Because if you're stepping across the line, it's time to compete. It's whether you win or lose. There are going to be times where you release a baseball with full effort and full body strength. You may be off technically. Well, the pitch is what you're concerned about. And if you're still making the pitch, you can worry about that in your bullpen session on the next time that you throw on the side. Same thing with hitting. You may be way off balance. You may have to lunge for a ball. But if you hit that ball and you hit it with authority, you may very well hit it out of the ballpark. We've seen that. Both of us have. Mm-hmm. The question becomes, are you going to allow me to compete? Because that's really why you're paying me the money. You're not paying me the money just because I can be a robot. You're paying me the money because I can handle the pressure when it rolls down in the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning. The bases are loaded. I've got two strikes. Am I going to fold on the mound or at the plate, or am I going to get it done? That's really why you're paying me. So let me play. Leave me alone. I'm not tired.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And we don't want to be too much of the old guys. Get off my lawn. But this is a fun conversation to have. All right. Finishing out that Central Division. We got the Pirates. They made a little noise early. We haven't heard from the Pirates in years and years. Last year, early in the season, they were making some noise. Ended up winning 76 games, which is better than they have previous years. What'd you see from that ball club last year? Do you expect anything out of them this year?
I think they have a young club. They've got a ton of big arms. Now, experience-wise, pitching-wise, I don't know that they're there. But I think they have a lot of young players and a lot of talent. And what happens in Pittsburgh is you roll in and you have no idea what the names are on the backs of the jerseys. And you find yourself in about the fifth or the sixth inning and you're like, damn, we're losing. And a lot of it is because when you prepare for a team that you have no idea what they can or can't do, those execution elements have to happen in the middle of the ball game. And sometimes that goes to the wayside. And all of a sudden you look up and the Pirates have beaten you 2 out of 3 and you have no idea who was on the team or who beat you. And that in itself gives the Pirates an advantage because nobody really knows who they are.
Give me your crystal ball. How does the division, who wins the division, over under wins for the Cincinnati Reds this year?
I think over and under wins for the Reds is somewhere around that 89-90 mark. I think that the Reds will be in competition with the Cardinals for when it comes down to the final day of the season. That's my guess.
Got it. All right, we're going to move on to another topic. Cowboy and myself were teammates, 94 to 97, one of the greatest teammates he ever had. A young Brett Boone. We've had a lot of people that have seen the young Brett Boone, the veteran Brett Boone. There is a difference. I had a lot of fun doing it. A lot of ice packs on the way, a lot of humble pie on the way, like we've all had. If you play this game long enough, believe me, you will get knocked. You will get knocked to your knees, and the ones that can get up and keep going. First of all, we were teammates. You moved on. I moved on. When did you decide you wanted to become a broadcaster? When did that stick with you? I know, got like Aaron started networking late in his career. All of a sudden, he goes right into the booth. I had a different take. It's when I was done, I took my uniform off. I said, I'm going hunting, fishing, golfing. And then I woke up 10 years later and go, I got to do something. Now I'm doing this podcast and I'm actually having some fun with it. But when did Jeff Brantley know, this is something I want to pursue after I'm done playing? Because you went right into the booth.
Yeah, it's funny, Brett, because when I was probably 9 or 10 years old, when every other young kid is thinking about being a Major League Baseball player and mimicking swings in the driveway and trying to pretend you're some great pitcher with the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth, I was listening to the voices of Mel Allen and Keith Jackson. Those are the kinds of – that just kept resonating in my head. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I finally made it to the big leagues and I was with the Giants, we're playing in a Hall of Fame game in Cooperstown, and we're playing the Minnesota Twins. And Mel Allen was at that ball game, and so was Ted Williams. Everybody on our club was talking in the dugout with Ted Williams. And I'm in the first base dugout and I'm watching Mel Allen walk across the infield. And I don't want to run out there and go, hey, I'm Jeff Brantley. But I got our general manager, who, by the way, was Al Rosen, who had known Mel Allen forever. I said, Al, I said, could you take me out and introduce me to Mel Allen, please? He looks at me and he goes, oh my God, is that what this world is coming to? He goes, this is the kind of kids I mean, it's just me and him now. He goes, this is the kind of kid I'm drafting. He goes, you got the greatest hitter of all time sitting over there in the dugout. The whole team's over there. And you want to meet Mel Allen? You want to meet Mel freaking Allen? You have got to be kidding me. Grabs me by the arm. He said, come on. We walk out there. This is the kind of introduction he gave me. He goes, Mel, come here. He goes, this kid wants to meet you. And he walks off. That was it.
Wow.
But that's what I wanted. I mean, I wanted to be Mel Allen or Keith Jackson before I ever picked up a baseball. So to be honest with you, Brett, I'm living my dream now. I just happened to live another dream before I got here.
You just had to pitch a little bit to get there. Oh, very cool. We played together 94, 95, 96, 97. 96, you were Rolaids, and I remember that year very well. 95, you were our guy. People, you know, that was the beginning of my career. I mean, I came up in 1992. You came up with the Giants much earlier than that. But even to this day, you know, when I get talked about, most of the questions I get asked are about my Mariner years. But when I have guys that talk to me about the Cincinnati years, I sit there and I relive it and I think, man, when I first got to Cincinnati, 94, 95, you know, we had Lark and Hal Morris and Tony Fernandez and Smiley and a young Pete Shurik, who you mentored a little bit along with a Jeff Shaw, who ended up being the closer when you left. He was your setup man. A Dave Burba came to us. We had some really good teams under Davey Johnson, especially that 94 team. We were wire to wire, you know, and like everybody else, they say, oh, yeah, we would have been great that year. Yeah, the Expos were really good. There were a lot of teams that were having big years in 94, but man, we were good. 95, we were really good again. Got to that Dodger series, swept them, and then ran into Maddox, Smoltz, and Glavin with that Braves, with that Braves team. But I look back on those years, we had some really good ball clubs. What do you remember about them and some of your teammates? And I'm going to get to it in a second. I'm going to get one story about a Marge Schott story. But what do you remember about those years and your teammates?
Probably as much as anything, we had a group that just – we had fun together, whether it was on the field winning, whether it was in the clubhouse after the ball game, whether it was going out to dinner, whatever it was. It just didn't seem like there were any, like, cliques or just sets that just sat in one side and didn't talk to anybody else. We had a collective group of veteran players that just kind of made everything fun. And, you know, to me, if you're all pulling from the same end of the rope, and we may not have been the most talented group, but damn, we competed like there was no tomorrow. I mean, there was always an expectation of winning every single day when we got to the ballpark.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I thought it was great. And I didn't even mention the Lenny Harris, who you'd mentioned. Huge part of that team. Jerome Walton.
Yeah.
Thomas Howard. They called themselves the stunt squad.
And
they didn't play every day. But when they did play, they were huge. That added to that team chemistry that you're talking about. Lenny Harris to this day. You know, you've played on a lot of teams. I've played on a lot of teams. Usually to be the leader of that team and the guy that people look to in the clubhouse, you're usually the star player, a middle of the lineup guy. But on that team, we really didn't have one guy that we looked at. But Lenny Harris, for being a utility player, a pinch hit extraordinaire, I think he's the all-time leader in pinch hits. He had a lot of gravitas in that locker room.
He did. He did, and he would tell guys. He would tell you. He would tell Barry.
He would tell Kevin Mitchell.
Yeah, he'd tell them all, look, you either pick it up or they're going to have to put me out there. I'm going to have to take your job. I'm very comfortable sitting up here. I mean, he'd just let you have it.
He would tell me, JB, go Boone. I'd be playing like 25 in a row, and he'd be like, hey, Boone, hey, could you let Coop get a start? And by the way, for you watching or listening to the Boone podcast, Coop – was Lenny Harris's nickname. And he'd say, Boone, can I get a start? Can I get a start? I said, Lenny, why don't you get a start somewhere else? I need to play second base. Now, I remember, I sprained my ankle in Montreal, and now all of a sudden I had to have 2 or 3 days off in a row. So Lenny's playing second base, and he went from, can I get a start, to, hey, they don't pay me enough for this. This is 3 days in a row now. I'm done. That's enough. But that's how that team was, and you're right. The camaraderie on that team was really good and really special. And I think at the time I was a young player, I butted heads with Davey Johnson quite a bit, only years later to look back and go, now I see what Davey Johnson was trying to do with a young Brett Boone. He taught me a lot of lessons. And to this day, I got to say, Lou Piniella is my all-time favorite manager that I played for. But as far as X's and O's start to finish, Davey might have been the most talented of getting the most out of individuals.
I agree with you. And people ask me that a lot because I played with some good for some good managers. But Davey being a former player, I think he understood the psyche of the player. And he was never one that would pat you on the back too much, but he also wouldn't kick you in the dirt too much. He just tried to keep you on the straight and narrow. He had no problem putting you on the bench or taking you out of your spot and having somebody else in there, but he would always give you a chance to come back. And I think what that did is it continued to push your competitiveness. You didn't have time to feel sorry for yourself. And that was just kind of the way our locker room worked.
You know what I really appreciated about him? Everybody knows as a hitter, if you go out and you go 3 for 4 with a 3-run homer, you make a great play in the field, we win. It's not rocket science. You had a great day. On those days that I had, and I'd walk by Davey Johnson, he might give me a little bit of a subtle smile. Like, way to go, kid. Now, the flip side. I go 0 for 4. I make a crucial error. We lose the game. I never saw that emotion the other way. It was never, it was never, there was no emotion. I'd walk by him and he treated me the same, pretty much the same as if I had a great day or I had a bad day. And as time went on, I learned to appreciate that consistency of him. He didn't show emotion. He didn't show you up as a player. He kicked you in the butt when you needed a kick in the butt, and he gave another guy a hug to get the same, I guess, level of play, state of mind that he thought that player needed to be in. And I still think to this day, as managers, yeah, anybody can get the lefty up, get the righty up. Anybody can have a pregame plan. But once that national anthem's over, it's all about the players. Mm-hmm. It's all about being a people person as a manager to know the individual, know their personalities, know their egos in some situations, how to get the most out of the individual. So this isn't Little League anymore. It's when you get to the big leagues, it's not everybody's treated the same. It's no, this guy needs to be treated this way to get this. This guy I need to do this for this guy. I get that result. And that, I think that's the master of being a great manager. And I think Davey was that guy.
Yeah. I think in our world of managing, and really is whether you're a coach or whatever your job is, you've got to be a people person. If you can't relate to individuals, because these guys, all of us, we have lives that are off the field, and you're bringing baggage to the ballpark every day. And your job as a coach is to help that player eliminate that baggage and to focus on the task at hand, which is playing baseball on this given day. And then you can take care of whatever happened at home or whatever happened on the way to the ballpark when the game's over. But I need you for the next 4 or 5 hours to be on your A game. And Davey was great at that.
You played for some other great ones too. Tony La Russa, Roger Craig in your days in Roger Craig and Dusty Baker, your days in San Francisco. La Russa, and he played for a gentleman that retired recently, Francona, with the Cleveland Indians. That's a pretty good resume. There's some Hall of Fame managers right there. All different, all the same. Did you take things from each one of them?
I think for the most part, they were all very good at handling And you talked about this earlier, about handling the egos and the frailty of the players. And I think they all had a knack of being able to lift you. But they all did it in a different way. Like Francona, it was never a hurtful word to get you to do what you were supposed to do. It was almost as though he would kind of shame you in that direction, as if, dude, you're embarrassing me out there. Hey, you gotta take care of this. I'm gonna look bad. And he would kind of funnel you in that direction. Roger Craig just was always upbeat, always kind of patting you on the back. You got this today. I mean, never a tough moment with that guy, and which was great for me, especially as a young player. I think Dusty kind of worked into that over a period of time, because he had been a player, he had been a hitting coach, and now he was having to deal with all these pitchers. And pitchers are just different than everyday players. It's just the way that it is, and you have to handle them accordingly. And if you don't, then they're going to fold back on you. And I think that in itself is why Dusty became a Hall of Fame manager rather than just going off to the wayside, is he learned how to manage his pitchers.
In those times in Cincinnati, I told you I wouldn't let you get out of here without a – you got a Marge Schott story for me. I've told all mine. Tell the audience out there what it was really like playing for Marge.
It was different. I didn't know how to respond, and I don't know that any human does. For someone coming up to you before a ball game with a bag of dog hair on opening day,
yeah,
and to take it and want to rub it on your skin, not on your shirt, on your skin for good luck. Now, there are a lot of guys that would freak out about that, and they would just run from the dugout. I don't know that it really affected me. I mean, I've always had pets, so it's not a big deal. But I think in her own way, she was trying to do whatever she could to help you get to a point where you could win. I know that everybody in some fashion or form has heard, well, she was cheap at this, she didn't spend on that. Look, when we needed a player, or we needed a trade, or we needed a free agent, and we had a team that was just one player away or maybe two pitchers away, she would make sure that we got that done. 95, perfect example, when we got Burba and we got Mark Portugal. I think those are the things that kind of get lost in all of those other stories.
No, I agree with you. And the dog hair, it's classic. I've told my elephant riding story. But every time, JB, I'd be sitting around the cage, and all of a sudden I felt a 65, 68-ish aged woman with her hand in my back pocket. And I knew exactly what it was. It was Shotzi O2's dog hair. And Larkin right there next to me going, Booney, you want that multi-year deal? You might let her, you got to let her leave the hair in your pocket. And I'll tell you what, JB, I'd go, if I went out that night and had a good night, I'd have that hair in my pocket the next night. Yeah. We are creatures of habit.
Yes, we are.
Couple questions before I let you go. I want to go, for you, you set up, you did a lot of different bullpen roles. You were a closer for years. Tougher for you, clean inning in the ninth coming in, or being that sixth, seventh, eighth inning guy coming in a jam?
I would say probably the clean inning more than anything else. And the reason I say that is when I got to the big leagues, I had an issue of I didn't throw a strike all the time. So I was always pitching with guys on base. And I think what Roger decided to do, and my numbers would reflect that over my career with him, what he did is he started putting me in the ballgame with the bases loaded. You have no room for error. You have no room to walk anybody. It didn't matter who the hitter was. He would put me in the ballgame with the bases loaded. My first appearance in the World Series in 89 against Oakland, he brings me in the ballgame with the bases loaded. And now let me remind you of this. We had three left-handers in our bullpen at that time. He brought me in the ballgame with the bases loaded to face Dave Parker. Now, me being a young Reds fan from the time I was a little kid till I actually played there, I knew damn well who Dave Parker was.
I mean, he was
a bona fide stud. And I'm thinking, we got a left-hander warming up right beside me, and he brings me in the game to face Dave Parker. But that was just how he used me. So I got used to that from the beginning on, and I learned how to basically approach every one of those situations, and it taught me body language of the hitter. Because guys do different things when pressure lays on them, whether it's movement of the hands, scrambling the feet, especially as the count goes on, hitters start to change a little bit. And that helped me recognize what those hitters were doing in crucial times. So when I did get into the ninth and I got a clean inning, if something happened that I gave up a double or a triple and I still had to get a couple outs, I didn't panic because I knew that I had this little weapon in my back pocket of body language, and it kind of told me what I was going to throw next. And it just gave me some comfort.
You know, Jeff, that was my biggest nemesis as a hitter, especially as I moved on in my career. Cause I'd prey on the pitcher that was so worried about facing whoever was up in the lineup that they didn't take the time to read body language. And the pitchers that would read my takes, oh, the way you took that pitch, you must have been looking for this. Now that chess match starts. When I knew you were so worried about delivering the next pitch as a pitcher, I had you. Because you weren't looking at my body languages, my takes. Same with a catcher that was really astute behind the plate. If he's watching me, if he's watching my mannerisms, he can tell what I'm looking for, what I'm not looking for. But when you start getting deep and you get a pitcher that's thinking with you, going, okay, this happened, and it could be in the series. It could have been two nights earlier. In this situation, the base open, we threw him this and he did X. He's probably looking for that. Soon as that starts, now you're throwing my game off, because I'm sitting there thinking I'm the only one that has this story written out. And I know how it's going to go. When you start countering how it's going to go, now it's on. Those are the things that I truly do miss in the game, is that cat and mouse with the catcher, the pitcher. I don't necessarily miss chasing that slider in the dirt with two strikes, but I do miss that chess match that went on in the minds of me versus you versus him. And those are the things I miss.
Yeah. I think every successful player has a list, whether it be a written list or whether it be a Rolodex that just comes through your head, of what a pitcher does when there's adrenaline, nervousness, anxiety, because we all have a tell, and we show that tell in the most crucial of moments. The guys that stay around this game the longest and the ones that are the highest end of players, they're the ones that can see those tells, and they can see it as clear as day. And you might be in a total fastball count. It might be 2-0, and the pitcher on the mound flips you that get me over slider, and you know that it's coming. God, what a great feeling. Shaka.
I love that. Bases loaded, hanging breaking ball, yeah, that you didn't think I was looking for. And I also hated that when I was looking for it, the four seamer down the middle of the plate, and then that catch and that catcher looks at me, Brantley, and goes, "Hey, Booney, you weren't looking for that heater, were you? Well, let's guess what you're looking for now." Now the game starts. Those wheels start turning. Jeff Brantley, if you had to pick three toughest outs you got to get in your career, who are the three guys?
Well, definitely at the top of that list is Tony Gwynn.
Okay.
As tough as they became. The second would probably be Jeff Bagwell.
Baggy, and underrated, great, great player. You know, I know it's a Hall of Fame, but
crazy, one of my favorites. Crazy thing about Bagwell is when he first came up, I got him out probably the first 14, 15 times I faced him, and had him 0-2 in Candlestick, the old stadium that the Giants played in. And I threw a ball up and in, knocked him down. He got up and kind of looked at me kind of funny, and I did it again. The third pitch that I threw him after being 0-2, he hit dead center at Candlestick, and I didn't get him out for another 20 at bats. Don't wake a sleeping dog.
Who's the third?
And the third would be Gary Sheffield. And not that Sheffield hit me that great. It was just that when he did hit it, the third baseman was mad because it was going by him before he could actually move his glove. Because Sheffield just took such a massive, just that huge swing. And just one of those guys that you knew if you hung it, you were going to eat it. But those are my three guys.
Very cool. Very cool. And I had a little list here on my notes. And Sheffield and Gwynn, I wrote down four hitters who I was guessing you were going to say. I got two of them right. I had Barry and I had Chipper Jones in there as well. Cowboy, it's been a lot of fun, man.
I'm doing it, bud.
We don't get to catch up that often. I will see you. I'm coming to Cincinnati, actually, I believe the 5th of April. So I'll be there for 3 days doing a couple appearances and some meet and greets and stuff like that. So I will be sure. Yeah, I'll come see you, check you out in the booth. It's been a pleasure, a lot of fun, great teammate, Wall of Fame, San Francisco Giants, and I appreciate you having on. Stay in touch. For all you guys out there watching the Boom Podcast, you can now see it on YouTube. For those of you listening, I appreciate you tuning in. Until next time, we'll be right here.